They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Crossover NBA Podcast. Glad you could join me, and we have a terrific show lined up for you this week. The NBA trade deadline has come and gone. Billy King, the former general manager of the Sixers and the Nets, he joins me in studio, and we talk about everything that happened from the Sixers moves to the Bucks moves and the big move that didn't happen. Anthony Davis stayed with the Pelicans. What does that mean for the Lakers, for the Celtics? I get into all that and more with Billy King. A little bit later on, it's never too early to start talking NBA draft. Jeremy Wu, the great draft analyst over at SISI.com, he joins me in studio, and we run through Zion Williamson, his Duke teammates, some surprises, the depth of the draft, some back-end guys. We talk about everything we know at this point about the NBA draft. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way to support it. Get over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. I check out those comments all the time, trying to bring you guys what you want to hear every single week. It is the very best way you can make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. All right, it's been a busy past week. The NBA trade deadline has come and gone. The landscape has been reshaped. Anthony Davis is still a Pelican. And the Eastern Conference, the top of the bracket, is going to be really exciting come postseason time. To break all that down and much more, I'm glad to have Billy King, the former general manager of the Sixers and the Nets. He's an analyst over at NBA TV, and he joins me here in studio. What's up, Billy?
How you doing?
I'm good, man. Happy that trade deadline has come and gone. It was frenetic. It lived up to expectations. But, you know, before I get into some of the stuff that happened, you were a general manager for a long time. What memories do you have about the trade deadline and just the overall craziness of it?
Well, it gets crazy. Like in Philadelphia, I think it was my first year. Remember, we were in Indiana and we had a trade we were doing, and we did another trade, and then we get a call with Ronnie Cycli because I think they were trading him somewhere and it wouldn't work. And so they call and they say, "Would you want Cycli?" And we figured out how to make it work. But the problem was, we were playing that night in Indiana. We needed 8 players, and if I made the trade, we weren't gonna have enough players to play, so I couldn't do it. And so, if I'd have thought about it, I could have signed Maurice Cheeks, I think, to a 10-day, and possibly done it that way. But yeah, but that was one of the wackiest one. Then another one, we were doing a trade. We had one trade call we were doing. And I told our CFO, who's my cap guy, also Andy Spicer, to call the league and let him know we got another trade we're going to do with Milwaukee. Give him the details, and he does. We finished the one trade. Sorry, let's do the next one. The league goes, "Well, you passed the deadline." I go, "Wait a minute. We told you about it." They go, "Yeah, but you didn't have Milwaukee on the phone." And I said, "Well, that's not a rule." And so I ended up calling above them, and we ended up getting the deal done. But since then, I think that's why the league put a lot of rules in place so that formalized it, because there really wasn't a lot of formal rules. It's just sort of the league would make rulings up there. And so they since have put a lot of parameters of things you have to do in order to set up a trade call. And then I guess my last crazy one was in Philadelphia, in Brooklyn, we were trading KG to Minnesota at the deadline. And he was at his house in Malibu because the team was on the West Coast. And in doing so, he needed to sign his no trade and to waive it, that he'd be willing to do the deal. And so we needed to fax it to him, and he couldn't figure out how to get the fax machine to work. And so we're scrambling. He tried another fax machine in the house. He couldn't get it to work. Finally, his wife got home. We got it back. I think we got it to the league at 5:58 to get the deal done, where we ended up receiving Thaddeus Young in that deal.
I swear to God, the backstories of NBA deals are more entertaining sometimes than the negotiations. Just like stuff like that. I mean, Bobby Marks, the guy that worked for you for years, he was doing a podcast over at ESPN, and he was talking just, and this isn't trade deadline, but he was talking about how you guys were, when you were trying to sign Deron Williams, how confused you were because Darren kept showing up at your facility, and you didn't know if he was going to sign a deal with you.
No, because we had our big presentation. Dallas went first, and we had our presentation with them. I thought it went well. And so the next morning, I go to the office, and I see his car there. I'm thinking, oh, that's a good sign. And then they said, Darren is working out in Cal Corp, happened to be in town. They're working out together. So I go say hi, and they said, well, come up after we finish. So they come up. We spend 30 minutes talking, and he's, all right, we're going to go to lunch. And he gets up. I go, well? He goes, haven't made a decision yet. And I go, what do you mean?
And he showed up for a few days after.
Yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah,
just
he did.
He kept showing up.
He did. And then the biggest hang up was he was having a hard time finding a place to live for his family. And, you know, he had a lot of, you know, he wanted a big enough place for the family, something comfortable. And I remember Jay-Z calling asking, you know, what, we're close? He goes, well, he's looking for a place to live. And Jay-Z goes, well, I know a lot of places that aren't on the market. Have him come by the house with his wife. So Darren and Amy went by and sat down with Jay-Z and Beyonce and got a call later at night. He was in.
Wait, so did Jay-Z close the deal on Darren Williams?
Well, I don't know if that was it, but after they talked about where to live, he said yes.
$100 million contract. He's looking for like a third floor walk up in Soho. It's like, I need a big enough place. I got to make sure there's a backyard. And
well, the hard thing in New York is, you know, you got, it's like once you buy it, and especially you spend the kind of money that, you know, he was going to spend, you end up redoing a lot of yourself, you know, to make it to your
it's
liking.
So hard, Billy. It's so tough. It's so tough, you know.
Yeah, only people like you and Darren and Jay-Z have those problems.
Oh, yeah.
The rest of us don't.
It's so tough to have $100 million and not know what to spend it on in New York City. My sympathies to the Williams family. It's wild, though, man, like the transaction business in the league. And that's what's made the league, I think, so popular over the last few years, because everybody – loves the stories that surround all these transactions. I want to talk about a big story of a transaction that didn't happen, and that's Anthony Davis and the Pelicans. As we know, to recap, a couple weeks before the trade deadline, Anthony Davis made a request to be traded. He took it to the Pelicans first. His agent, Rich Paul, went public with it, and that kicked off one of the wildest weeks I can remember before a trade deadline, where the Lakers, who were the preferred destination for the team, for Davis rather, they were trying to get into the mix. The Pelicans were, from what I was told and reports indicate, were not at all interested, to the point where they weren't even returning phone calls. Meanwhile, you have the Boston Celtics, who are effectively pass blocking on all this, just, you know, trying to make sure the Pelicans don't do a deal so they can get their opportunity to make a bid on Anthony Davis, because as we all know by now, because the Celtics had Kyrie Irving under contract, they couldn't make a deal involving Davis that didn't involve Kyrie Irving. So before we get into the specifics, your biggest takeaway from the craziness of the past week and Anthony Davis?
Well, I just think there were a lot of the deals that happened were deals that people didn't hear about. And those are the ones that tend to happen. When the Anthony Davis deals get out there and it's in the public, those are the deals that become difficult, because other teams get in and start saying, wait a minute, I can give you this, I can give you that. So it makes the other team that has Anthony Davis pause a little bit and say, well, wait a minute, maybe we should wait a little bit, because there's these deals, some teams are saying, hey, this summer I can give you this. So, you know, if you can keep it under wraps, you tend to get the deal done. That's like when the Knicks did Porzingis to Dallas. It was quiet. They got it done quickly. If that would have got out, the Knicks would have been inundated with a bunch of offers and then had to sift through everything. And some of them may have been better, some may have been worse, and that had made it more complicated. And also then you have Porzingis sitting there saying, oh, wait a minute, you're trading me. So a lot of these deals that happened yesterday, you know, the day before, like Tobias Harris, nobody talked about them and they were able to get done. And that's how in this business, if you're going to get deals done, you got to try to keep it under wraps as long as possible, because you don't want other teams getting in. Because usually as a GM, when you hear a deal, You make the call and say, wait a minute, I can give you something better. You try to just mess it up so it doesn't get done.
What did you think of the Pelicans' decision to wait? There are obviously logical reasons to do it. Boston can probably put the best offer on the table come July 1st. Of course, there is a risk that Davis would say, I'm not going to re-sign with Boston, which would affect their offer. You can wait till the lottery odds shake out. Maybe New York gets number one. And maybe the Knicks come up with a package to try to get Anthony Davis as well. On the flip side, there is, again, some risk to it. So what'd you make of the Pelicans' decision not to do anything?
Well, I think they had to look and see what was the best they could get and then make a decision. If that's if you think you can get better this summer, then you wait. And then you got to have a plan to deal with it, which they have to now deal with Anthony Davis, knowing that he's leaving, knowing that you trade him. The fan base know he's leaving. So it's a little awkward situation, I think, for everybody involved, especially the fans. I think they're the ones that are sitting there watching a guy knowing that he's not going to be playing for them next year. But I think at the end of the day, they made the right decision because you have Boston. But just like Kawhi Leonard, when he came on the table, nobody thought he was going to go to Toronto because everybody kept saying he wanted it had to be L.A., had to be L.A. Well, Toronto stepped up and made a deal that San Antonio liked. And now they are in the position that, you know, he's playing on a team that's one of the tops in the East, and he's got to make that decision. So by waiting, I think they open up a lot more for themselves. Like you said, the Knicks. If the Knicks hit number one, now you're looking at possibly Zion Williams, and Knicks have cap space, and you can try to get rid of, clean up your books a little bit. So, and the one thing that a lot of people talk about, in the summertime, you have more, there's no limit on your roster spots that you can take in. During the season, you're limited to, you know, 15 roster spots, so you don't have to cut guys. During the summer, you can take in as many guys as you want to get a deal done, and just have to have your roster down to 15 by the opening day. So it gives you a lot more opportunity if you, when you wait. So I think waiting for them was the right move.
To your point about Toronto, I think people don't look at hard enough the fact that Oklahoma City jumped in and acquired Paul George when nobody thought that Oklahoma City would give up any assets to go and get him. Toronto jumped in and acquired Kawhi Leonard. There could be a mystery team out there. Maybe it's Chicago. Maybe it's, I don't even know, somebody else that says, look, we'll take a flyer on this. We'll roll the dice and acquire Anthony Davis and hope that we have enough success and he has enough comfort that he wants to stay. So there could be, I think, a mystery team that we're not talking about that could make a run at Anthony Davis come July 1st.
Every team is out there. All 29 other teams are looking at now. How do they get in the mix? And they're going to be talking to Dell Demps right now. They're talking and saying, you know, this summer I can do this, and Dell's going to have a lot of offers to look at. But you're right. I think there'll be a team, and I always say there's a, you know, Pat Riley in Miami is you never count them out because Andy Ellisberg does a great job with their cap as their GM, and they'll put together some packages that'll make Dell have to think about it. But there are going to be a lot of teams that are going to try to get in the mix and put the pressure on Rich Paul and say no.
You mentioned Rich Paul and Clutch Sports, and they kind of orchestrated all this behind the scenes. They made the trade request. They made the decision to take that request public. I know, Billy, that irked people in New Orleans, that this became a public spectacle. And I think that, I don't know if that was an overriding decision in their reasons for not trading him, but it certainly bothered them. What do you think of how Anthony Davis's reps played this, and was it the right move?
Well, I think it's not good for the game. I don't think it's good for the league when, you know, players have the right. I'm a firm believer they have the right to leave when they want to leave. And, you know, especially when he's been there as long as he have, if a player, because teams trade players all the time. So players, if given the opportunity for, you know, to want to move, they should get that opportunity. But I think the better way to do it is behind the scenes. You know, let them know, hey, we're not going to re-sign. We'll work with you to try to make a deal, but, you know, we'd like to be out. When you go public, it just becomes it's not fair really to Anthony Davis or the fan base, but especially Anthony Davis, because now he's got to go play for another 28 games there knowing that he's not going to be there. He's got to live there. To me, it's better to work behind the scenes. And whether Porzingis told the Knicks he wanted to be traded or not, or they got that impression, they were able to make that deal and move him without it being public.
It felt like to me, and you can tell me if you agree, disagree, that they rolled the dice that they could put enough pressure on New Orleans to make a deal with the Lakers, knowing full well that if they went to July 1st and went a pretty easy route, I mean, the easy route to go that would save Anthony Davis a lot of grief would be just rejecting the contract extension, which, as you know, is that's tantamount to a trade demand. I mean, if you don't turn down, if you don't take the $250 million that they're offering you, you know that you want out. They rolled the dice and they thought that they could get the Pelicans to make a deal, and it backfired. And now Anthony Davis is going to play the rest of the season, but his minutes are going to be scaled back. He's probably not going to play in back-to-back situations. And he's going to be, I would think, booed lustily, at the very least, when he's on his home floor. And, you know, based on everything I know about Anthony Davis, Billy, I don't think he wanted that. I mean, look, ultimately it's his decision. He has to sign off on everything that happens. But everything Anthony Davis has done over the last few years has told me that he doesn't want the drama around him, that he may want out of a situation, but I don't think he wants to be the villain in that situation.
No, I agree 100%. That's why I think it's best to be quiet and do it behind the scenes. You know, I was involved with the Dwight Howard thing, and I think Dwight's image was never the same after it became public that he wanted out. Anytime a player makes a public demand, you're basically telling that city, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be part of this city. And if you've given your blood, sweat, and tears, that becomes difficult. If you leave and leave quietly, you know, then teams say, okay, well, he's a free agent and he has that right. Or the team is end up going to be trading him, and they can blame the team and not Anthony Davis that the team traded him. The team obviously will come out later and say that, yeah, he wanted to be traded. But it's, you know, it's not like him coming out publicly saying, I want to be traded.
Did the Lakers do all they could from what you know about this situation? You know, by all accounts, they were willing to part with virtually every part of their young core. They were willing to go as deep as 2 first-round picks. They probably, you know, could have pushed it even further and gone with another pick, some swap rights, things like that. But they seem to have elected not to go. Did you feel like, based on what you know about this, that the Lakers did everything they could?
I think they did, and I think they were smart to pull out and say, you know, we're not going to do anything until you make a counteroffer, because all they were doing was setting the table for the next team to say, okay, we know we can get this. You've heard from the Lakers, so you've got to beat that. And so they're letting Boston know, like, this is what we had, so now you got to go better than that. So I think by pulling out, now they need to just focus on the young guys and get them playing and LeBron and not worry about Anthony Davis and not talk about it the rest of this season. But I think it was smart. They made an offer. They pushed. And then when New Orleans didn't counter, they just said, okay, we're going to, you know, pull out and wait. Because if they kept going and kept going and kept going, all of them were setting the table. We went through it with Carmelo. We were pushing and prodding and pushing and pushing, and, you know, so it upped the ante for New York, and, you know, so it cost New York a lot more, but, you know, we didn't end up with them.
The concern that you have, though, with the Lakers is if you don't get him now and Boston can somehow convince Anthony Davis that that's where he needs to be, Kyrie Irving comes back, the Lakers could find themselves in a pretty big predicament over the next couple of years. At this point, it doesn't seem like they're the front runner for any of the top-tier free agents. Maybe that changes, but at this point, it doesn't seem like they're the number one option for the top-tier guys. And if you look ahead to the summer of 2020, outside of Anthony Davis, it's not a great class. I mean, Draymond Green is going to be in it, but most of the other top-tier guys are restricted free agents that, as you know, very difficult to actually get your hands on. And, you know, LeBron is still LeBron. I was at the Celtic game against the Lakers this past week. He's still a magnificent talent, even at 34 years old. But the clock is ticking on him. And if you're going to make him the centerpiece of a championship-winning team, you've got to put together that championship-level team sooner rather than later. So I think there's a pretty – it feels like, to me, the urgency should be really high within the Lakers to get Anthony Davis over these next few months.
Well, I think they'll keep talking to them, but I think that another route they can look at is also with the trades. If you have that cap space, teams can trade you players, and there may be a disgruntled star who's under contract that they can maybe trade into.
True.
It may not be Anthony Davis. So I don't think they have to just solely focus on the free agent class. You know, the Clippers wanted a different rate. They moved Tobias Harris. It may not be that big name, but it could be some key pieces that you can continue to build with, because they do have some three good young players that they were offering, and you trade a couple guys in there. Maybe you get one guy that maybe is not Anthony Davis or Durant, but it's another key free agent. Then you trade another guy, and you can build a team that way. You don't, it doesn't always have to be you've got to sign that free agent, because very rarely are teams – Golden State was lucky they got Durant. The Lakers got LeBron, but right now they don't have anything to go with them. There's not a lot of situations. You know, the last one I can see where they built a championship team just by adding free agents was Miami, when they got LeBron and Bosh to go with Dwayne Wade. But generally, it's, you know, draft picks along with some trades and maybe a one or two key signings.
I remember years ago you called me, and it was after I tweeted something about a potential deal maybe involving Mirza Teletovic, I think it was. And I'm paraphrased, but I think you said to me, like, you know, like, what the fuck? We're not trying to trade this guy. Like, now I got to go talk to him about this. And yeah, I, because it was out there, and then you felt as the GM, you had to go and talk to him about this. I bring this up only because the young players in LA have seen their name attached to trades for the last few days. And I don't know how they interpret it. So if you're Magic Johnson and Rob Pelinka, is there anything you have to do, and Luke Walton as well, but is there anything you think you have to do to try to heal some of this? Do you have to be proactive, or you just say it's a business, be big guys and deal with it?
Well, I think you do have to talk to them because they are young players, and this is the first time really they're going through it. It'll happen again in their careers, but I think you owe it to them as an organization to talk to them. And I think it's Rob and Magic that need to talk to them. You know, I did it in Brooklyn when we had Brooke Lopez. I spent time talking to Brooke and telling Brooke, hey, look, it's, you know, there's truth to the, you know, we're trying to get Dwight Howard, but don't get caught up in the rumors and like that. If there's a deal that's going to happen, it's going to be me that I'll tell you that's going to happen. Anything you read in the paper, there may just be rumors, but right now you're here. And then when we didn't trade him, I said, Brooke, you know, I'm glad you're here. Keep working, keep getting better. And to this day, I still talk to Brooke via text. And, you know, yeah, when he plays a good game, when he's in LA or now in Milwaukee, I talk to him, he responds. So, but I think you owe it to them. I think they understand it's a business, but they are human beings and they're people. So, and the biggest thing is their family's involved. That, you know, so I think you owe it to them just to talk to them, and so to keep them informed, keep them. And just say, hey, we may not be getting Anthony Davis, so we'd like to build with you. If you can go out there and prove it that we should not trade you, then go play. And have, you know, but it does fall on the organization. You know, Luke is going to coach and do his thing, but I think it's management's got to be the one that's talking. And I think you have a team meeting about it and talk to everybody about it. This is who we are for the next 27, 28 games, and nobody's going. We may add another piece via the buyout market, but we can win, we can make the playoffs, and that should be our focus, because if we do that and we have success and win, say we get to the finals, win a championship, we're all going to benefit from that.
All right, on the other side of the coast, you have the Celtics, who didn't do anything really at the trade deadline. They moved off Jabari Bird, but nobody really noticed that. But they still, I don't know if they were throwing a party there, but there was genuine excitement that the Pelicans held on to Anthony Davis because they will get their shot. What do you think the next few months are like for Danny Ainge? There are a lot of layers to this. There's the Kyrie layer. There's the who do you trade layer. There's will Anthony Davis re-sign their layer. If you're in Boston's front office, what do your next few months look like?
Well, I know, knowing Danny, he's focused now on just trying to win a championship because, you know, they have a team, you know, they lost to the Lakers, but they've got a team that has proven they got to the Eastern Conference without two of their all-stars. They add them back. And now with this short amount of time, that's their focus. They can't do anything about July 1st until July 1st comes. All they can do now is try to win a championship. So that's going to be their main focus. They know, you know, they'll have plenty of time to focus on Anthony Davis or what if Kyrie's coming back. All they can do right now is try to win a championship. And so that's, you know, Danny is probably relieved that the trade deadline is gone. Also, Anthony Davis is still in New Orleans, but now he can just focus on his team and try to get them playing better and try to get them to win because, you know, right now that's their main focus is how do we win a championship and come out of the East, especially and then face Golden State.
So you don't do any kind of back channeling at that point to kind of, at least when it comes to Anthony Davis and his willingness to play there, that wouldn't be on your mind at this point.
I would be very cautious about doing it because now in today's day, if you do, it'll probably get out, and then that could become a distraction, which detracts you from winning a championship. You can do all your due diligence and find out information so that you prepare, but I wouldn't, if I'm Danny especially, trying to make calls to try to persuade him to come there because if you win a championship, that's going to be a lot of persuasion right there. Because, you know, hey, this is an organization that's won. Look at all the banners up there. We just added another one. So if he starts reaching out and talking to people, there's going to be enough people calling him say, I'm hearing this or that. I don't think he needs to initiate anything because their main focus has got to be winning. Because, you know, if they don't win a championship this year, it's going to be a disappointing season for the Celtics.
All right, you mentioned winning, and it got a lot tougher over the deadline because the Eastern Conference teams, they all upgraded at the top. Let's start with Philadelphia. who made several moves in the days leading up to the trade deadline. The most significant being getting Tobias Harris, who is a borderline all-star player in L.A., having a terrific contract year season, averaging close to 20 points per game with the Clippers. They also moved off Markelle Fultz, trading him to the Orlando Magic in exchange for Jonathan Simmons. Let's start with the Harris acquisition, Billy. They now have four guys that are legit scorers, top-tier players on their respective teams, two of them before they got to Philadelphia. There are also four guys that are going to command a lot of money over the next couple of years. Joel Embiid is on a max contract. Jimmy Butler wants a max contract. Tobias Harris rejected an $80 million extension last year, and he's having a better year than the one he had this past season. Not to mention Ben Simmons at some point. The bill's going to come due on him. What did you make of the Harris move for Philadelphia?
Well, I'll start at the beginning of the season. I thought they had a nice team, but I didn't think they had a team that could compete at the top. Then when they added Jimmy Butler, I thought that gave them a versatile defender, tough, hard-nosed guy that could help the young guys win in the playoffs. Then, yeah, but I thought their bench was a little weak. Then adding Tobias Harris now gives them another proven scorer. You know, so now we have five guys out there. You play with Ben's got four options that he can find, and the floor is going to open up for Ben. So now I think you'll see him penetrating more, posting up more. But I think the key pieces for them is adding Ennis, adding Simmons, and adding Mike Scott. Those guys give them a lot more depth on their bench. They added more athleticism with Simmons and so. That was the biggest problem I thought they had when they played Boston last year in the playoffs. They weren't athletic enough to compete with them on the defensive end. You know, Bellinelli gave them great offense. Ilyasova, great offense. But I don't think their athleticism competed with Boston. Now they have athletes to compete with Boston, Toronto, because I think Toronto's a very athletic team. So is Milwaukee. But now also they can score the basketball. So I do like what they've done. Financially, it's going to be, you know, some – the ownership's got to make a decision. But when the valuation was now $1.6 billion, I think Forbes just came out with – I think they have the ability to go in the tax. I know their owners aren't worried about the tax. If they have to go in it, the great thing about them is they can see how this team plays in the playoffs and make that decision. How, you know, do they want to go deeper or spend more money? At the end of the year, if say it's not where they want to be and they don't finish where they want to be, they can say, okay, you know what? I know we gave up some assets for a Jimmy Butler. We'll just re-sign Tobias Harris and maybe build that way because we don't want to go spend that money. But I don't think these guys are worried about spending money when you've got, you know, a bunch of billionaires in their group selling out the building. It's great atmosphere down there. So I don't see them worried about that going forward. It is a big number they're going to have to pay. But if you've got four of those guys and you can add pieces around and they've got some picks, I think they'll be okay. Because when you've got a team like that, other guys will take less money. I'll go there and play for the minimum. I'll go there because we got a chance to win.
I think they overpaid for Harris. Two first-round picks, pretty steep price.
Yeah, no, I do think they overpaid there. But I think they were looking at knowing that Toronto was probably going to keep making deals to get better. Milwaukee keeps making deals to get better. So as I think Daryl Morey said, it's an arms race. And you don't want to find yourself just on the outside and you pass because you may have given up that pick because you really only have a couple chances to try to win a championship. And if you got a team, you look at, we were talking about Anthony Davis earlier leaving. Why is he looking to leave? Because they don't feel they have a chance to win in New Orleans to compete. So you don't want to put yourself in a position where Ben Simmons looking, well, why am I going to stay here? You know, we just me and Joel and we don't really have a chance to win. I want to go somewhere else to have a chance to win. He can't say that about this team now, especially if they commit dollars to keep those guys.
Elton Brand didn't draft Markelle Fultz, and I think that made it easier for him to move off him because he doesn't have that kind of attached to his draft record. Still, I mean, we knew if they were going to have to move off Fultz, they'd have to sell low. Jonathan Simmons is a nice player, but certainly doesn't have the upside of Fultz. They also got, I believe, a protected first-round pick. I think it's a protected first-round pick.
Yeah, Oklahoma City, I think, protected 1 through 20.
That pick's been moved around like
six.
I think Philadelphia
Phil had it, yeah.
Yeah, so then they get it back in the Fultz trade. But what did you make of their decision to cut ties? I mean, look, they've been kind of passengers on the Markelle Fultz train for a while now. I mean, his agent and his team have kind of been dictating everything that's been going on with his career and his treatment for this most recent injury. But what did you make of the decision to kind of say, all right, we're done, we're moving on?
I think it was the right decision. Rather Elton drafted or not drafted him, I think it was the right decision because, one, It's a lot of money, but also it's a body that you're not using. It's just sort of an empty roster spot that's sort of not playing, and they need somebody. If they're trying to win a championship, they need somebody that can go out there and compete. And I always believe once a player is drafted, that's great where they were drafted. But once they start playing, especially into their second year, that draft slot's gone. You know, it becomes, what have you done in the league? That becomes your value. And he had no value going forward. So, you know, to get a pick out of even a protected pick, and I think he got a second or a couple seconds out of it also, they've got some assets out of it at least, because if they didn't play him the rest of this year, this summer he would have had no value. And so then you're talking about, do you pick up his option? And if you don't, you may lose him for nothing. So at least they got something back for it. And they got players that can play that, you know, Brett Brown now can put Simmons in the game. He couldn't put Fultz in the game. So, you know, it was eating into their bench rotation, just not having a guy that can play.
Do you think Fultz can be resuscitated and have his career revived? I think he's going to the right place. I spent some time this past week in Charlotte with Kemba Walker, and we did a long form interview kind of on his career. And he, you know, when I asked Kemba what the turning point was of his career, he said Steve Clifford. He said when Steve Clifford got the coaching job in Charlotte, he helped, you know, turn him around with both confidence. They changed, you know, one of his coaches, an assistant there, changed his shot. So it helped Kemba Walker. Maybe he can have the same impact on Markelle Fultz in a very low pressure environment where Markelle Fultz is not the number one pick. It's not a major market. There's not a lot of eyeballs on him moving on. But I mean, you can certainly wonder if this kind of injury / case of the yips, whatever it is going to be career threatening. What do you think about the chances that Markelle Fultz has of living up to his expectations?
Well, one, I think getting out of Philadelphia was good for him because the pressure of being the number one pick was always going to hang over his head. But going and play for Clifford is going to be great. But also, he gets the ball in his hands. I think as long as he played in Philadelphia with Ben Simmons, it was not going to be successful because I think he needed the basketball in his hands to be able to penetrate, do what he needed to do. He wasn't a spot-up shooter, so he wasn't going to fit there. Going to Orlando, they're going to give him the ball, let him play, let him handle the ball and be a playmaker. And I think Steve Clifford now can coach him and teach him being a point guard in the league. And I think he'll find it much more easy to play there. And also, Orlando is not at the top. They're not trying to compete for a championship. So like you said, the pressure of playing out there, if he makes a mistake, it's not going to be as a big a mistake as it is in Philadelphia. If he goes in the game in Philadelphia and gets a wide open shot, which he was going to get, and he doesn't knock it down, that next shot becomes a lot more pressure. In Orlando, if he misses a shot, you know, the next one is not as much pressure because, you know, they're not competing for a championship.
Yeah, he misses a shot in Orlando. It's not leading the highlight shows.
Exactly.
It's just a missed shot from a young player. It was Orlando or Phoenix to me would have been ideal destinations for him, and I think he landed in one of them. All right, let me finish with a couple things real quick. Nikola Mirotic, he goes to Milwaukee. I think John Horst has done a sneaky great job the last couple of years. I mean, he's identified the weaknesses in this team. He brought in a great coach in Mike Budenholzer, and he surrounded Giannis with the type of players you need to surround Giannis with, that being shooters. He brought in Brook Lopez, who can be a space five, Ersan Ilyasova. Now you bring in Nikola Mirotic, who came this time last year to New Orleans and revitalized that team because his floor spacing opened everything up for Rondo and for Davis and others. Now he's going to be asked to do the same thing for Giannis. I just think that's a round peg, round hole type of fit. What do you make of what the Bucks did at the deadline?
Well, I think John has done an amazing job. I think when you're identified you're going to hire Budenholzer, then you've got to build a team that fits him. If you look at what Danny Ferry did in Atlanta with Budenholzer, and they went and got shooters, where there was Korver from Chicago in a trade. You know, they added enough pieces around. Millsap was a guy they got low and cheap, and he had, so they built a team that became a three-point shooting team, space to floor ball movement. And now you add Mirotic to that roster, it's just another guy. When they traded for Stanley Johnson, I was like, wow, Bud must have a way he's going to fit him in because he wasn't a three-point shooter, but then they knew they were moving him on. So I think it's a great fit for the GM doing a great job of putting pieces around for the coach to be able to use. Now Bud has – he's like a chef now. He can take – you know, I'm going to put a little bit of onion here, a little bit of salt and pepper, and the soup comes out tasting good. And when you have a guy like Giannis – you want enough spacing around so he can be able to penetrate. Brook Lopez is always spotting up, and the centers are helping on Giannis, and Brook is getting a wide open three. So I think they're a difficult cover, But adding Mirotić is another great piece for them. The big thing, and it goes back to what we talked about before. They're showing Giannis, hey, we're willing to build a team here that we can win with. And so now he's looking to say, if he's, because he's going to be coming up for free agency soon.
Right.
He's not going to say, well, geez, I can't win here. He's saying we can win here, and we are winning.
I think that's a huge part of it. I mean, Giannis has to be looking around. And Giannis, up until this point, has struck me as a guy that's pretty loyal, that wants to be in Milwaukee, but certainly wants to win. Now he has an elite head coach, and that's what Mike Budenholzer is. I believe he's elite. Do you think he's an elite coach?
By far.
Yeah, no question. And John Horst, who is doing the job, putting the guys around him, that makes sense. Now, this summer, I think, will be big. You know, what kind of moves do they make as they've been positioning themselves to have some cap space to make a significant deal? But they're doing everything they possibly can. And I think this shows, Billy, that you know, everybody kind of says, let's get superstars. That's what Philadelphia is trying to do to a degree, and certainly what Golden State has done over the years. This team has one bona fide superstar, a solid all-star in Chris Middleton, and then guys that play roles. Good players, but guys that play roles. And if you put together a team with pieces that fit, you can have much more success than just throwing a bunch of stars together.
Well, and if you look at Golden State, you said Golden State really, they didn't have stars. They became stars.
Right.
You know, and that's the great thing about it. They became stars. If you look at San Antonio, they had Tim Duncan, but then Ginobili became a star. Tony Parker became a star. And so sometimes just acquiring guys, and you know, in Brooklyn we tried to, it doesn't work. But if you can develop some stars and maybe add one to the mix when you need it, it helps. But I think there's always a different way to build a team, but I think you always got to do it some through the draft, because those contracts help you with your cap. Then you got to do it some by signing, and then a lot of it's done by trading the right piece that fits for you also.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you lastly, the LA Clippers, what they did this deadline, moving Harris. I thought they got great value in a couple of first-round picks for a guy that they probably weren't going to re-sign. Maybe they consider it the right money, but if there was teams out there willing to max Tobias Harris out, that wasn't going to happen. They're willing, it seems, to slip into the lottery, which protects their first-round pick from being transferred over to Boston. We know that they're all in on Kawhi Leonard. That is their number one free agent target. And they've put together a decent team of young players around him. What do you make of the Clippers and how they've operated, not just the deadline, but over the past kind of 6 months?
Well, I go back before that. It was the decision when Chris Paul was going to Houston. And they, you know, so decided, okay, we're going to let you go to Houston. We're going to make a trade and let you go there. Then it was the Blake Griffin trade to get that money off the books. Then DeAndre Jordan. So they cleaned their books up along the way and getting pieces that Doc could coach and that will listen to him. And then this up making a decision, okay, is Tobias Harris going to be our max guy? Because every team, that guy may not be a max guy for somebody else, but he usually is your max guy. He was going to be their max guy. How good were they going to be? Were they going to be able to compete in the Western Conference at the top? I don't think so. So they said, let's move him, get some more assets. And then this summer, we'll build a team that we think we can grow with to try to be in a position. Because you got to look at Golden State is probably 3 or 4 years, they're not going to be the same Golden State team. So you want to be in a position, if you're them, to be able to rise up and be ready to take over when that team starts to fade.
Yeah, I think they've done a nice job and did the right things because they weren't, even if they snuck into the playoffs, it was going to be one and done, and you know, getting two first-round picks. And everybody's pretty high on that Miami pick. I'm not so sure why. Like, when was the last time Miami, you know, tanked? Ever? That's going to be like a mid-first-round pick no matter what.
Yeah, the 1 year they tanked, that's when they got Dwayne Wade. But since then, because that's not in Pat Riley's, you know, DNA. It's not something he wants to go through, because once you're at the top and you sell and take, and you take that dip down, there's no guarantee you're going to get back there. Look at Orlando. They traded Dwight, got all those assets, and they're still trying to climb that mountain. It's a long climb, and you got to get lucky. Philly got lucky with Embiid, but it doesn't always turn out that way.
Yeah, and if you make a deal involving a player like Dwight and Anthony Davis, you better make sure you get the right package back in return.
Exactly.
That's franchise changing. Billy, always appreciate your time, man. Great stuff. Thanks for joining me here.
Glad to be here.
My thanks to Billy King for joining the show. And now, my conversation with SI NBA draft analyst, Jeremy Wu. All right, so the NBA draft is months away, but with the NCAA tournament just about a month and a half away, conference tournaments just about a month away, now is a good time to start looking ahead to this year's draft class, especially in the aftermath of the trade deadline where, you know, picks were talked about, some were involved, and certainly teams will be looking to add depth in the draft. To break all that down, let's bring in Jeremy Wu, who does a great job covering the NBA draft over at SI. You can read his stuff at SI.com. Jeremy, what's happening, man?
What's going on, man? Just, I think, processing the trade deadline like everyone else.
Yes, yes. I'm still processing it, but hopefully I can get out of my head pretty soon. I'm looking forward, though, to learning more about this draft class, because it's one of those classes where I think everybody knows who the number one pick is and, you know, is excited about him. But after that, it seems to be a little bit of a crapshoot, at least a lot of unknowns in the minds of fans anyway that are out there. So hope you can educate me on a few things. But let's start with Zion, who, I mean, he's widely projected to be the number one pick. In fact, we heard during the trade deadline that one of the reasons the Pelicans either did or should have held on to the Anthony Davis was to see who landed that number one pick in case they wanted to flip Davis for it for the rights to draft Zion Williamson. So give me your, you know, NBA draft kind of take on Zion.
Yeah, you know, I think coming into the season, he was a guy who fascinated me more than anyone else. And I think, you know, looking at, you know, Duke played a couple games in Canada on the exhibition tour, and, you know, Zion and Barrett were both playing. The other guys were hurt, Reddish and Jones. But, you know, just looking at Zion in the context of the modern NBA, it's just, I think that, you know, you see teams starting to build around, you know, unorthodox, unique, you know, ball handlers, right? And, I mean, you can look at, you know, from a James Harden who's not really a traditional point guard, who's sort of transformed into that, and you have, you know, a Ben Simmons or a Giannis who are, like, you know, oversized guys who can play make, and the most important thing is shot creation, right? And, you know, these guys come in different shapes and sizes, but when you look at Zion, I think the biggest thing that was undersold with him coming into the season, and I think that's probably why people were not right on top of it coming into the year, was just how skilled he is, how unselfish he is, and how efficient he can be without necessarily, you know, dominating the ball and shooting every shot. And so I think if you're looking for a player to build around, especially in the context of this draft, which is not, you know, like you said, I think a lot of the top guys have been sort of up and down. Not a lot of guys making great, overwhelming cases as, you know, you should definitely draft me high. You know, Zion is the guy. And I mean, now looking at the stats he's put up, you know, I mean, they're historically good stats for a college player. So I think, you know, even the most traditional thinkers when it comes to evaluation are sort of starting to come around on him, you know, as the guy, whether it's in absence of another, you know, great option, but also just, you know, being a historically good player.
There have been some, you know, consensus number ones over the years. You know, LeBron, consensus number one. Anthony Davis, consensus number one. Yeah, but other drafts where it's been kind of, well, we'll take this guy at number one, but I don't know if we think he's a true franchise player. You know, in other drafts, would Zion be as clear-cut a number one as he seems to be in this one?
I think if you, I mean, for example, if you dropped him in the last year's draft, I think it would be close. I think, you know, I mean, then you have, what, Ayton and Doncic, and now we know what we know about them. I mean, these are two very good players. I think if we redrafted last year's draft, Luka would probably definitely be one, right?
Sure.
But, I mean, if you put him up against Luka, I mean, you know, they're different, but I think it would be a debate, right? And you can go back. I mean, Zion versus Ben Simmons, you know, again, now we know more about him. But at the time, you know, there was some doubt about Simmons, too. So I think, I mean, even if you go back and you drop him into these drafts, I mean, he's the type of player, you just look at what he's done and how unique he is, that I think it can work. But I think he's even more appealing now, just if you can envision him, you know, putting shooters around him, you know, he's going to draw so many fouls. You know, who's going to stay in front of a guy that big and explosive in space, right? I mean, even you can put a grown man on him, but he's still, you know, going to have that edge, right? So, you know, I think he holds up really well with the past number ones. You know, I'm not going to say he's LeBron, but I think he has a chance to be, you know, that type of, you know, transcendent player. And I think that's something not a lot of people expected coming into the year. So, you know, that much I think is refreshing at least. But it is interesting, especially in the context of Anthony Davis, right, where, you know, this is now a legitimately huge trade chip if you mm-hmm. win the lottery. And, you know, maybe that's not the case every single year.
Yeah, I mean, there was some talk. I mean, Knicks fans are by definition crazy, but there was some talk like maybe we don't want to deal Zion for Anthony Davis. I don't know if I go that far. Anthony Davis, a 25-year-old superstar, and Zion has bright a prospect as he is, still a little bit of an unknown. And the unknown part of him, and I don't get too worked up about guys that can't shoot in college, but you know, every time you see clips of Zion that hit Twitter or YouTube, wherever, he's making a steal. He's, you know, taking on four guys. He's dunking in a variety of different ways. I don't think I've ever seen a pull-up three-pointer from Zion on a YouTube clip. What can you say about his perimeter game now and, you know, any flaws that might be in it that need to be worked out the next level?
Yeah, you know, I think the shooting is a concern. I don't think he's going to be a non-shooter. You know, I think it's something that can improve. Coming into this weekend, he's shooting like 28% from three on 42 attempts. So it's not a volume thing, right? But at least he's shooting it, right? And he's not afraid to shoot it. I don't think he necessarily has to be a 40% shooter with the way he plays, to be effective, right? And I mean, again, you can look at Ben Simmons, who, you know, different case, right? But he's a huge guy who has an athletic edge all the time and can get into the paint when he wants and has great vision. And, you know, I don't know if Zion is that caliber of passer, but just in terms of being able to get into the paint, being able to sort of counter, you know, the majority of the time, you know, when teams try to sag, you know, there's something else he can do, right? And, you know, if he goes off the ball, I think you have to still worry about him running the baseline. You know, he can catch it and go up and finish. And, you know, I think the shot is probably the biggest thing he needs to add. But the fact that he is a good ball handler, you know, he has room to improve there. You know, the fact that he can get downhill so easily, I think is going to negate some of those concerns, right? And I think, you know, clearly he's a very smart player as well, which I think is going to help.
Yeah, and he's got that great wingspan. He's got all the physique to be. I mean, do you see him as a small forward? I mean, it's become less and less important in today's game. Tweeners are sought after guys. Guys can play multiple positions, but how do you see him project the next level position wise?
Well, I think he's a four because he's going to have to defend fours. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of the time that's sort of what it comes down to. I think there'll be some wings you can throw him on, but it's not going to be, you know, something you always want to do. You know, I think the majority of his defensive value comes from, you know, what he can do as a help side shot blocker, you know, roving and sort of getting steals. You know, I think he is most valuable sort of in that role where he can kind of, you know, take risks and, you know, use his instincts. I think, you know, isolated in the perimeter, I don't think he's necessarily going to be like a shutdown guy, but I think he is definitely a positive impact player on that end, just in terms of, you know, how quickly he can create a turnover and turn that into transition, right? I think that's the other thing about him, is just how quickly he can turn anything, grab a rebound and go, throw an outlet pass. You know, he has the instincts. He can turn, you know, he can basically create those transition looks out of nothing, and that's efficient. I think that, you know, he's probably a four, but, you know, you're going to play him on the ball a lot. So he kind of transcends some of those questions just with how good he is at what he does.
Is there anything you've learned, you know, either from your own observations or from talking to different people about his kind of mental makeup? And, you know, is he one of those guys that relishes a leadership role? Is he kind of more reserved? How would you characterize him as a locker room guy / leader?
Yeah, he, you know, having, you know, been around him a little bit, I saw him a couple times in high school, you know, I think he has the right type of personality to where, you know, his teammates like him. You know, I think he's more of a, I get the sense he's more of like a lead by example guy. He's not necessarily like a rah-rah guy, but not a lot of kids at 18 are that, right? So I think he has a chance to, you know, with the personality he has, he's a likable guy, you know, clearly from a marketing perspective, you know, he's going to be incredible for, you know, whoever sponsors him, you know. But I think the personality, I think that stuff is going to check out, you know, and you can see what's actually impressed me is being in the Duke locker room, seeing, you know, Zion and Barrett, who, you know, are the maybe 1-2 picks, you know, they get along so well, and it seems genuine. And, you know, that much, I think, says a lot, just that, you know, those two guys, you can sort of maintain a healthy relationship.
Yeah, so let's talk about those guys, because this is one of those drafts where we could see, and I guess probably will see, three Duke players if they all come out drafted inside the top 10. RJ Barrett, considered a top 5 pick. Cameron Reddish, considered a lottery pick, certainly, probably inside that top 10. Start with Barrett, who is, you know, has been ranked right up there with Zion for much of the season. What kind of seasons he had, and how do you see him?
You know, so RJ coming into the year, I think consensus-wise was the number one guy. You know, we had Zion 1 on our site, but, you know, there was nothing wrong with having RJ first, just based on, you know, what he had done in high school. You know, I think he gets a lot of credit, deservedly so, for, you know, winning championship with Canada as a high school player, you know, sort of being the leader of that team. You know, the way he's played this year, I think, relative to my expectations, has been about right? You know, he really can score. You know, he's just bigger and stronger than a lot of guys his age. You know, he's able to get into the paint. He's not always been efficient, though, and I think that's become sort of the biggest knock on him is the shot selection, right? You know, some people say he shoots too much, but if you look at how Duke plays, I mean, they really need him to score. So it's not the volume so much that concerns me. It's just, you know, the three-point shooting, he's still, you know, working that out. His touch from there is not incredible. You know, and I think if you put him up against Zion, I mean, you know, there's also a shooting concern with RJ. But then, you know, just settling for mid-range shots, you know, kind of flinging up looks that, you know, aren't necessarily, you know, the ones that, from an NBA perspective, if we're talking about how do we run an efficient offense, you know, maybe not the looks that we want, right? So the question is just, you know, how much is he going to adapt? You know, how much will he change to sort of fit the way you want to play? But I think there's definitely a floor there just with, you know, his overall talent level. You know, he's very competitive, very, you know, a hardworking player. You know, his dad is a player. You know, he has the right type of makeup, I think, to be very successful going forward. I mean, you know, to me, he's, you know, a good bit behind Zion just in terms of, you know, I just think Zion's, you know, more of a unique, you know, guy that we haven't seen. And we've seen guys in RJ's vein where they're really ball dominant scorers. But, you know, if your team, even the Knicks, you know, who really could use a, you know, perimeter scorer who did sort of shoulder some of that load, I think he's going to be very appealing.
So where does Reddish fit into this mix? Clear third guy on the depth chart, and how do you project him?
You know, I think for some people, there's some debate between Barrett and Reddish. You know, Barrett's play has been better. Reddish, with him, he's scary just because of how inconsistent he's been. And this is something that dates back to high school and I think has been sort of one of the bigger, you know, things for people to figure out. You know, I know, you know, a lot of teams are still figuring him out and have had, you know, been frustrated trying to evaluate him for the last 2 years just because, you know, there are games where he does nothing. There are games where he'll look like he could be the number one pick. It's been more of the you know, underwhelming side, I think, at Duke this year. And, you know, on one hand, people are saying, well, you know, he's not, you know, getting the type of volume shots that he's used to, right, with RJ and Zion on his team. But the flip side, I think he actually should be in a great position to succeed being able to play off those guys, right, as a, you know, he's the best shooter of the three in terms of touch. And, you know, he's skilled, he's big, he, you know, defensively will be able to, you know, defend a few different positions. So I think he brings a lot in terms of NBA fit. But that's also sort of looking at his game from an idealized perspective, right? So I think there's more risk with him just because you don't know what you're going to get. He's not a guy who's necessarily shows up every game. And it's just a matter of, you know, how do we get the best out of him every night? And I think, you know, at some point in the draft, it's a risk that is worth taking. You know, for me, he's behind those two guys, but I could see him, you know, he's a guy who, you know, if he plays well down the stretch, you know, could maybe jump RJ. I don't know if that's going to happen. And there hasn't necessarily been an indicator that that'll happen based on the way he's playing, but, you know, it is interesting, and it's just, this is really the first time we've had to evaluate these three guys as teammates who could be top five picks.
So Zion, everybody heard of going into this this college basketball season. Barrett, Reddish, most people knew of because of their high school careers. I got to tell you, I didn't know who Ja Morant was until, like, a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have picked him out of a lineup. I might have thought he was a boxer for all I know at this point. You spent some time at Murray State. You did something on him for the magazine recently. I mean, where has he come from, and what kind of prospect is he really?
Yeah, you know, he's been kind of a breath of fresh air in this class, you know, especially it being sort of a weak point guard class, and I think it's become pretty obvious that he, you know, is probably going to be the first guard drafted or deserves to be. And, you know, Ja, you know, he's an interesting story because he's a kid who really did sort of come out of nowhere. You know, he ended up at Murray State. You know, the story's out now, but, you know, people sort of know the deal is. But basically, you know, he ended up there sort of almost by accident. He got discovered playing in a back gym. He didn't really have any big offers, right? He had two offers. And so Murray State comes in and they sealed the deal and they got him. And, you know, last year he was their starting point guard and, you know, played the whole time and was really good. And I know, you know, there were teams where he popped up in their models as a guy who, you know, could be really good. And then he goes to the Chris Paul camp over the summer and lights it up. And, you know, I think the games he had this season against Alabama and Auburn were, you know, pretty convincing, you know, at least testaments to his talent, right? So, you know, I mean, he's averaging double-double with assists, or I think he, I don't know if he still is. I know he was at least a couple weeks ago, right? So that's pretty impressive. And even doing it for Murray State, I mean, I think you just got to watch him, and you see, You know, just the way his feel you know, for passing and scoring and his athleticism. I mean, all these things really pop. So Ja, I think, is, you know, most people, I think, agree he's going to be a top five pick now. I think it's, you know, absolutely for real. I don't think it's a case of, you know, a small conference guy beating up bad competition. I mean, if you look at the way he's doing it, you know, I think there's a lot to like.
I feel like I don't ever want to hear, like, you know, who's he playing, like, competition-wise, because every time that subject comes up, the guy that comes out usually plays really well. Like, the days of, like, mid-majors being dismissed are long since over. I mean, the Lillard-McCollum years, you know, that began all this, and every year it seems like we have somebody in the lottery from a mid-major that pans out. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like competition's overrated at this point.
Right. And you understand, you know, understand that he was a late bloomer, you know, knowing, you know, personality-wise. I mean, he's a guy who works really hard. You know, he is a film addict. You know, he watches film of every game. You know, like, all that stuff you're going to hear is real. I mean, he, you know, is very sort of a, you know, refreshingly sort of, you know, unassuming kid who's not just still getting used to the fact that he's good, right? I don't think he knows how good he's going to be or can be, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think all those things are going to put in his favor. And I think also just the fact that teams, you know, are going to need point guards at the top of the draft. You know, he's a guy who's going to have a chance to be really good. And I think, you know, people, I think you've seen a lot of Westbrook comparisons thrown out there just because of the fact he's, you know, putting up triple-double type guys. But the guy here reminds me more of is Rondo, just in terms of, you know, his passing vision. You know, he's not... He is very athletic, but he's not just, like, dominating games with his athleticism. And he's still pretty skinny, right? But, you know, if he's Rondo with a jumper and a more likable personality as a teammate, you know, and I'm talking about early career Rondo, right? Yeah. I mean, like, that's a pretty good player, right? And that's, you know, just when you sort of wrap your head around that concept, I mean, you understand why he should be a top, you know, two or three pick.
Hell, Rondo with a jumper alone is a really good pick. I mean, Rondo, you know, if not for the bumps along the road, be a Hall of Fame type player, but... it's interesting because it is going to be the top of the draft. If you look at the bad teams right now, starved for point guards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, who knows what Orlando is going to get out of Markelle Fultz and Phoenix. You know, they're always hungry for point guards. The Knicks, if they don't get number one, that'll be interesting to see how he does in the combine process and all that pre-draft stuff. Okay, so that's the top tier guys that I want to look at. But one thing, and again, I don't do much talk of the draft, but in the build up to the trade deadline, there was a lot of talk about the value of picks and, you know, this year's draft. And I heard pretty consistently, Jeremy, that this year's draft wasn't very strong. I mean, there was Zion at the top and people view him kind of as a consensus number one, but the totality of it isn't very strong. Now, on one hand, that kind of drives me a little bit crazy because, I mean, guys drafted in the 20s, you know, aren't supposed to be blue chippers or guaranteed guys. That's why they're drafted in the 20s and second round draft picks. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody knows what they're going to be. Nobody knows if you guys are going to be Draymond Green or Frederick Weiss. I mean, it doesn't. I think Frederick Weiss is a first round draft pick. But anyway, what have you heard and what have you seen and what do you think about the depth of this draft? You know, beginning in the lottery and kind of all the way through.
Yeah, in the sense I get is sort of the same as you. I think a lot of teams are underwhelmed just by the overall depth, at least at the top of the draft, right? Like, if you look at the guys in the lottery, there have not been a ton of super convincing cases. I mean, you have injuries to guys like Darius Garland and Bol Bol. You know, Kevin Porter has been sort of, you know, in and out of the lineup, hard to get in rhythm. You know, Romeo Langford has been up and down. You know, Nasir Little had a slow start to the year. And so, you know, all those guys, you know, you could sort of order them any which way, depending on who you are. I think the value of a first probably in this draft, you know, I mean, a first is still a first, and you still can try to get a guy you like on a, you know, cheap deal, and that, you know, that's still valuable. But, you know, I think there's going to be some discrepancy from team to team, maybe more than usual. You know, I think there are some good, you know, role player type guys when you get into the middle of the draft. You know, I don't think it's necessarily a bad draft, but if we're talking about it from the perspective of how many stars are there in this draft, then I mean, your guess is as good as mine, right? I mean, maybe mm-hmm. two, maybe one, right? So, you know, last year, I think, is in contrast when you had at least six or seven guys at the top you felt pretty good about, all those bigs. You know, people liked those guys. You know, you could have them in different order, but you kind of knew they were going to have a chance to be, you know, good players. And here, you know, this year, I mean, even starting with Reddish, we talked about, but it's just sort of a wild card in some ways. You know, it just gets more uncertain. So, you know, I think it's a year, a lot's going to depend on March, a lot's going to depend on the combine as usual. And, you know, it might be a draft where, you know, if a kid tests who no one's expecting to test and a team likes that guy, maybe you promise him in the 20s to try to keep him in. You know, it's the type of year where something like that, to try to get a guy you want, you know, those finesse tactics are going to make sense.
So tell me, you mentioned Bol Bol and obviously got hurt, missing the rest of the season. You know, fascinating name to people. Everybody knows who his father is, Manute Bol, former NBA player, big, big guy. Bol Bol is a big, big guy, 7'3", 7'8" wingspan, just a skinny guy too, just 236 pounds for 7'3". What kind of prospect is he? I mean, you look at the size and the reach and obviously that's appealing, but what kind of prospect is he? And did the injury, how much did that hurt him going into this process?
Yeah, you know, he scares me, man. And he's always, you know, dating back to high school, I saw him a good amount, and he's always scared me a little bit, just, you know, looking at the body type, right? But, you know, how many guys his size, you know, can play more than 15 minutes a game in the NBA, right? You know, his dad was a, you know, beloved player, but also, you know, realistically sort of a middling, you know, center. And, you know, so you have to put those, you have to decide what you first feel about just his, you know, how confident you can be projecting him as a everyday player. You know, I mean, some people were throwing out Porzingis because he's big and can shoot, but I don't think it's fair to compare anyone to Porzingis because that guy is, you know, very fluid, very athletic, you know, not going to be another guy like that, right? So, you know, Bol is a guy who I could still see going into the lottery if a team is like, you know, we feel good about the foot, we're going to take the risk, we have more than one pick, you know, this draft sucks, right? I mean, there's different ways to rationalize, you know, taking a gamble with him. You know, he's never a guy who I've been super high on. And just you watch him, you know, I think he gets pushed around by bigger guys on the inside a little bit. You know, his shot blocking is more, you know, we can get out and, you know, he can cover ground quickly, but if you get into him, it's not like he can really, you know, contest everything. So, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, reasons to be concerned. And, you know, the stuff you hear about his work ethic has not been great. You know, I don't like bashing kids too much, but it's just, you know, getting back to high school, you know, the stuff that's followed him around has not always been, you know, super encouraging. So, you know, I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if he, you know, figures it out and ends up being a steal if he falls out of the top 10. But, you know, I also won't be shocked if he's, you know, very, you know, in and out of the league quickly.
So the guys that are outside the lottery, those guys in the late teens into the 20s, even second round guys, who's the most, is there an intriguing guy to you or guys that you're kind of keeping your eye on as we begin this tournament process?
Yeah, one guy who I think is interesting, who I think has a chance to maybe sneak into the lottery, is KZ Akpala from Stanford, you know, I think he's probably, most people view him as like a mid to late first round guy, but I think he has a chance to be really good. You know, he's really long. You know, he was a point guard in high school and had a late growth spurt. So guys like that who have growth spurts end up usually being more skilled at their size, right? And the Pac-12 has been a mess, so it's hard to really sometimes get a feel for it. You know, people haven't necessarily been watching it that closely, but, you know, I think Akpala is a guy who could, you know, play his way into the lottery just with the upside there. I'm trying to think. You know, I love the kids in Iowa State. You know, I don't know who is coming out and who's staying there, but they have two freshmen, Talen Horton Tucker, who's from Chicago, so I've, you know, gotten a good look at him over the years. And then this kid, Tyrese Halliburton, who really came out of nowhere and has been, you know, one of their best players, if not their best player this year, just in terms of facilitation, right? And so these are two interesting guys where, and again, like I said, you know, because this draft is so thin, you know, if you're a freshman like that who's shown a lot of promise and you test, you know, it might be a good time to, you know, see what happens. And I could see guys like that, you know, staying in and, you know, being first-round picks just based on the upside, right? So, you know, those are some examples. I mean, I think, you know, you go up and down. I mean, there's guys from Tennessee, you know, Schofield and Williams have been really good. You know, you can go all over the country. I mean, there's good players who I think are going to have a chance to, you know, really help their stock.
You know, what's interesting is I kind of looked at the mock draft boards. One thing that stuck out to me was not a lot of Kentucky guys in the mix this year. You know, you've got, Keldon Johnson inside that top 10. But not, I think you had to go down to what, to Hagans, right? To at the back end of the first round, maybe have somebody there. I mean, what is, it's interesting that, because Kentucky's usually that kind of, you know, the prospect factory there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because their team has actually been really good in the last month. Mm-hmm. You know, they've really improved. They've won what, I think coming in this weekend, like 8 or 9, right? So, you know, but it's not the same type of Kentucky team when we had, like, you know, the John Wall, Marcus Cousins type teams. You know, it's not like that. But, you know, there is talent there, I think. You know,
but even in the Archie Goodwin years and, like, you know, mm-hmm. Poitras, Caldwell Pope, you had the Harrison twins. I mean, you had some guys. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like there was more depth. This year, not really.
Yeah, I mean, well, you have Keldon, who I think is a pretty safe choice as a lottery guy, and you know he's so competitive and skilled, and I think you know he may not have a ton of upside, but I think he'll play in the NBA for a long time just with his makeup and you know the positives with him. But I mean, the guy who I think is interesting with them is Tyler Herro, who has played better. You know, he started off the season slow. I think it was a confidence thing, but he can really shoot it. And you know, when you have that elite skill, you can shoot it. He can play make a little bit. You know, he's a guy who I think can sneak into the first round, particularly if he keeps playing well. And then you got PJ Washington, who I think is more of a role player, but has a chance to go in the first. But you know, again, like you said, it's not a year where there's like a overwhelming, like going to be like, you know, three Kentucky guys in the lottery, right? But you know, I think it's also just, it just sort of goes to show. I mean, the last few years, I mean, they've recruited well, but it hasn't been. You know, I think you've seen more. The talent's been more spread out in terms of who goes where.
Last year we had, you know, Luka drafted inside the top five, and as we talked about, he might be the best player coming out of that draft. What does the international class look like in this year's draft? Everybody's kind of was kind of intrigued if who's the next Porzingis or Luka or whomever to jump into that class.
Yeah, you know, there's not one of those guys this year. There's not, and I think, you know, scouts will tell you it's not like a crazy great international class. I mean, Sekou Doumbouya from France is probably going to be in the lottery somewhere, and he's you know, he's 18 and has an interesting, you know, frame. He can shoot a little bit. He's had kind of an up and down year in France, sort of adjusting to the level. You know, it's his first year playing pro A, and but you know, you have kids like that when they're 18, you're really just looking at projection, and you know, I think he's a guy who, you know, has some, you know, chance to be, you know, a good player. But, you know, I think there's him, and then you have this guy, Goga Bitadze. I think that's his name, how you say it. And he's Georgian, right? And he's playing in the EuroLeague now and has been really good. And so, you know, I think those two guys are probably in the first. You know, Lukas Samanik is an interesting name. He's a Croatian guy playing in Slovenia right now who, yeah, I don't know if he'll come out for sure, but he has a chance to be in the first round. But it's not a great international class, and there's no guy who's going to blow you away. There's no Luka or Kristaps in this draft. And, you know, that's just a function of time, you know, up and down years.
Do you have, when you talk to people on different teams, does the subject of the eventuality of high school kids being allowed to the draft come up? But if it does, in what context? I mean, are teams already kind of preparing for that moment to happen, whether it's 2022, 23, or, you know, somewhere in that range?
Yeah, you know, I think everyone knows that's coming. And, you know, I'll tell you, I mean, a lot of teams aren't happy about it just because, you know, if you think about, just from a scouting perspective, you know, you have to widen your net. You might have to hire more people. You're going to have to, you know, go to more stuff. You're going to have to, you know, really, you know, background is going to be deeply important, you know, when you're drafting a teenager. And so, you know, it's going to add even more uncertainty to the draft process, you know, whether it is 22 or 23. You know, I think you'll see teams expand their staffs. I think, you know, people, I mean, if you look back, I mean, the success rate is not great with teenagers, right? So you really got to be sure. And even now, you know, just having a hard time evaluating some of these freshmen in college, you know, if you take away the whole year of a college sample away, you know, it's even harder to peg, right? So, you know, I think it's good. I think it's, you know, what should happen. I think it's fair to the players for it to happen, but it's going to create a whole new set of challenges for teams again.
It's a ways off, but, you know, as you look at this draft and we talk about being not great in terms of overall talent, down the line, I mean, as you look at the high school classes and you talk to different teams, like next year, the year after, do people talk about which draft or which of the upcoming drafts they're most excited about? Is there one? Is there anything you're able to glean off that?
Not yet. You know, I think, you know, next year's draft is sort of right now hasn't totally taken shape. You know, there's a few kids who would go number one, but it's not. It's sort of like this year where there's still some things that have to be worked out, and we may not know, you know, exactly how we feel about it, and, you know, until, you know, November or December. I don't think it's like an outstanding draft yet, but, you know, I'll do McDonald's and see those more of those guys again and whatnot. But I think the thing people are thinking forward to is the draft where, you know, when you do take away the one and done rule, and then you have what, a freshman class of college players and a high school class. I mean, that's basically a double draft, right? And I think that's a eventuality people are preparing for sure. You know, it doesn't really matter who it is, just when you basically double the pool of eligible players, I mean, that's going to be a nightmare to scout and to evaluate. But it also means those picks can be more valuable, right? So when you see, you know, 2022 or 2023 firsts now being traded, potentially, right? Like, for example, the Mavericks and the Knicks swapping those picks. You know, I mean, those are picks that could be pretty valuable. You know, I think as that gets closer, I mean, you might see teams be more hesitant to trade those future picks.
Mm. All right, let me finish with this. If you take away, let's just say take away the three Duke players even. Definitely Zion, but let's take away the three Duke players. If there's somebody out there that you would say right now can't miss, like this guy I would put everything behind is going to be an NBA star. And remember, I'm going to record this, and this is going to get cold takes exposed on this podcast at some point if you whiff. Who would you take?
I mean, it's got to be Morant for me, man. I think it helps that I have an understanding of his situation. But, you know, beyond him, you go down the line, and there's just not a lot of guys you can really necessarily fall in love with, you know, in terms of upside, right? I mean, there are what-ifs all over. But, I mean, I think Morant, you know, has the best case, you know, with his skill set being what it is, you know, with the potential to be a better shooter, you know, as athletic as he is, you know, he gets a little stronger, you know, being able to just see the floor. And, you know, again, if you you know, they're a good mid-major team, but if you put Ja on the floor and you put four NBA players around, I mean, he's going to be so much more dangerous as a passer too, right? He'll have more space to operate. You know, guys are going to make more creative cuts. He's going to find them. You know, he's consistently able to find guys like that. You know, he's just such a smart player. I would definitely bet on his work ethic and his brain more than anything else, making him successful.
Interesting. Well, they definitely point guard is the glamour position in the NBA. It's what centers used to be. So if teams can get a chance to grab a franchise point guard, they're going to jump at those opportunities. Jeremy, always appreciate your time, man. We'll do this again when we get a little bit more clarity in the next month or so. Thanks for coming in to do this.
No doubt. Anytime.
All right. That's it for this week's episode. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.